there's no shortage of like things that are happening for kids and for families, right. But in the way that we're doing it from the ground up with the community and, you know, pushing for something larger in the way that we are, because again, it's not just an event, you know, this is a part of a larger thing. I think, yeah, there is nothing like this right now.
This is the Bruce Poinsett Show. This is the Bruce Poinsett Show. Oh, the world's most dangerous infomercial. I'm your host, Bruce Poinsett. Along with my producer, Ado, we bring you this weekly commentary and interview experience from the Numbers FM studio at the Portland Art Museum. This is the best of the Bruce Poinsett Show, the world's most dangerous infomercial. I'm your host, Bruce Poinsett, and along with my producer, Ado, we bring you this weekly commentary and interview experience from the Numbers FM studio at the Portland Art Museum. You can catch the full show every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM 96.7. You can also catch clips on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett, plus exclusive bonus content on patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett. Make sure to follow us on twitch.tv/TheNumbersFM, that's Numbers with a Z, or the Numbers Podcast Network on thenumberspodcast.com. Again, that's Numbers with a Z, or wherever you get your podcasts. This is the Bruce Poinsett Show, the world's most dangerous infomercial. Got a couple special guests in the studio today. We're talking about the Kids Outside Festival 2, and I'm going to let them introduce themselves, actually. So, yes, on my left.
Donovan Scribes, I'm the project manager for the Kids Outside and co-founder to the whole movement.
And my name's Laquisha Manyweather, and I am with Tenacious Rose.
Awesome. Well, yeah, thank you for being with me today, this afternoon. And for those who don't know, Kids Outside Fest, it's at George Park in St. John's. It's also, shout out to Matt Randall, who couldn't be here. Also one of the minds behind it, but features activities for family activities, performances. And I think the idea of like how it kind of came together is just sort of around, like a revival of George Park, would you say? But yeah, can you just talk about that a little bit more? Like what was like the, I know we talked a little bit about this last year for the first one, but you could just talk about like the genesis of this event.
Yeah, the foundation of this is Matt. He grew up in that neighborhood. He grew up literally across the street from George Park. And he and I had done some work before. And he just gave me a call one day and was like, you know, this park, it really needs some life in it. It doesn't have the proper equipment. And his son was really young at that time. And he still lived across the street from there. And he just wanted to see something different happen in the park. And he didn't know how to go about it. And so he gave me a call to see if I could help because of the work that I do in terms of organizing and policy work and everything. So we linked up at that time and tried to figure out a chart for it. I'd never worked on a park before, but we slowly but surely have been able to get some momentum behind not just people imagining what could happen there, but you know, having conversations with the city and some governmental agencies about what we're hearing so far and trying to push it into becoming a reality. And so the festival is just one part of that organizing that we're doing in terms of like, yes, we're having people come out to have a good time and everything, but it's ultimately about continuing to push the vision forward and say that we are here and that we do want to see something happen at George Park.
Can you just talk a little bit more about kind of like that vision for, you know, what you'd like to see with George Park going forward?
Yeah. So when we very first started moving forward on this, we put out a survey and it was during COVID. So we weren't able to hit the ground in the same way, but we put out a George Park improvement survey and we got like dozens of responses on there. And everybody who responded to the survey was from St. John's. And then when we were finally able to get past COVID and have the first festival, then we got even more responses. And so we were able to get more than 100 responses to our survey about what people wanted And I think one of the best things that happened with that is like the majority of the people were non-white. And I think it just in terms of St. John's and representing like the perspective out there is, you know, there's a lot of different ethnicities out there. But it just showed that we were engaging with people who were from there and also people who might have been pushed out, mm-hmm. you know. And so that was important for us to not just get people who are living there now, but ultimately what we'd like to see is a park that's not just put together, but something that represents the culture and the diversity of St. John's. And so that perspective is coming through with some of the work that we're doing and some of the things that people want, at least through the survey that we saw. The number one thing people want is lighting. And that's not even, you know, the most revolutionary thing. It's just like, it would make it a lot more safe out there if there was some lighting, because basically the pheasant inside of the park, and I guess I should mention, like, this park is surrounded by four different schools. It's got Roosevelt High School on one side, George down the street on the other one, James John on the other side, and then Sitton Elementary right around it. So it's like right in the heart of St. John's, right in the middle of these school zones, and still is not a place for kids necessarily to like go play, you know. And so yeah, in terms of the lighting and everything, it just gets pitch black once sun goes down on one side of the park. And so that came through in the survey. And then also what came through, people really, really want a basketball court there. But I think in terms of what's of the park, I think everybody kind of knows in general, like if everybody been to a park, you know, there's lots of fun things that you can have that go in a park. So those things are, it's good to hear from community, like what are some of the things that could go in the place. But what we really like to move into, like with this next phase of work, is like, how do we start actualizing these things? How do we start moving into the real nuts and bolts of like, we've heard some things from people. How do we kind of like get this synthesized into some, like, we're really going after these core things and then really build it out around the St. John's identity. And so that's going to take the city, the Parks Bureau, and, you know, some of these other agencies to really be partners with us and moving this vision forward and be active with that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And kind of like speaking of partners, you know, LaQuisha, and correct me on the number on this, but McDonald, you're telling me you sourced 100+ backpacks with school supplies, yeah. Feminine hygiene products. Like, so this is also an opportunity just for, again, just to get resources to the community. But can you just talk a little bit more about like the importance of using events like this for, you know, being able to, yeah, again, just like take care of the community with stuff like that?
Yeah, I always say that I think it's really important to take care of the community that you're in, and to make sure that the community feels supported and that our children are going to school prepared. When we think back to school, a lot of the times we're giving out pencils and binders and backpacks, and that's a big part of it too. But a lot of the times we're not thinking about the kiddos who maybe didn't get new clothes and their parents now need to wash laundry. And it's important that when we're thinking about back to school, we're also thinking about all of the barriers that could be there to like not feel successful and prepared for your first day. And it's important that those kind of resources are coming from people in the community.
Yeah, actually, to that point, can you just talk a little bit more? You're from St. John's, right?
I am, yeah. I grew up in St. John's.
Do you have memories of George Park as a kid?
Yeah, I went to George Middle School, and I lived right by Roosevelt. So I would walk from George past the park and then get home. And a lot of the times we would stop, there's like a little store right across the street from the park. We'd stop there, get some snacks, hang out in the field, and, you know, talk and, you know, hang out what kids do at parks.
So to that end, can you just talk a little bit more about like why it's important just being from St. John's, being from the area, to be leading work like this?
Yeah. I think a lot of the kiddos, well, I mean, I can't even say I think because I am a kiddo from North Portland. You sometimes feel like there's nothing you can do to change where you're at. There's nothing that you can do to improve where you're at. And I think it's important for the kiddos that are seeing TKO and the changes that we're going to make as a community to see that someone, me and Matt from St. John's, that are doing that. I think it'll inspire them to be able to be like, oh yeah, I can do something different. My voice does matter, you know?
Navi, you kind of mentioned some of the different like partners, organizations involved, but can you just talk a little bit more about, because like to do this is a big undertaking. It's a big, quote unquote team effort and all that. But yeah, can you just talk about like, who are some of the different players involved just to make this all happen?
The core partner is Summer Free For All, which is a program of the Portland Parks Bureau. So we partnered with them last year and were able to get that partnership again. And so the Summer Free For All program, you know, they take care of all the like foundational pieces of putting on an event. Like they put it to us like this, I think the first go around, like an event will happen whether you're there or not, like, because they've got the tech, they've got the, you know, all the microphones, they've got support staff to make sure, you know, the nuts and bolts are taken care of. They've got the porta potties and all of that stuff. And, you know, as the community partner, you're putting $1,000 forward towards, you know, all this infrastructure that would cost a lot of money. That's the core partner. In terms of some of the other parts that really are making this year's event go, Care Oregon stepped up as a core contributor this year. They're giving some major support for this year's event. And actually, it's funny because Matt's day job is at Care Oregon. And just by chance, one of his coworkers had been to last year's event, saw some of the promos, the early promo that was going out, and had dropped the like event page or something in like the chat during a work meeting. And then we were like, oh, Matt, that's you. And because of that, we were able to like have some conversations with some of the leadership at Care Oregon and able to get that sponsorship. So that was a big thing for us. And Wonderfolk, I got to give a shout out to Wonderfolk too, because we've been looking for our fiscal sponsor just for TKO altogether this year. And so they were able to come through, give us that fiscal sponsorship support that was really key to, you know, moving the work forward, not just for this year's event, but just for the general infrastructure as we move into more fundraising for this work. So, you know, they started, a lot of people might know them as, why am I forgetting their name right now? They had a name change. The first thing that went in my mind was literally saying New Beginning Global, but that's I think it was Global Works. Global Works was the name of their organization before. And they had a name change, but before they were kind of taking kids out on trips outside of the country for the first time for most of the kids, and that was the core functions. But now they're doing some more on the ground work with kids and having them figure out issues that are happening in their community, and the adults kind of coalesce around those issues to make change. So it feels like a real natural fit for the work that we're doing. So I would say those are the core partnerships outside of some of the people that will be actually there performing or doing things at the event.
Yeah, to that point, let's talk a little bit about this year's performances. I know Matt's going to be on stage for sure. But who else is going to be there this year?
This year we have a performer by the name of Selah. Selah is going to be performing. He's part of MBG with Matt, but he comes to us by way of Texas, I believe Houston, and currently is stationed in Seattle, so he'll be making that trip down, especially for this event. And then we're also going to have Yawa, who a lot of people know as Amenta Abioto, So it's been a long time since I've seen Aminta perform, but she's always does something dope with her performances. And, you know, she's using that loop pedal and kind of freestyles to performances and everything. So I think that's going to be something that the crowd can really get into because it's a lot of free form. And I think it just can get people hype. And then, of course, like you said, Matt will be performing. But those are just the onstage elements. We also are going to have Nikki Brown Clown come in again and doing what she does, which is, you know, keeping energy super duper high for the kids out there. She was actually, we were doing another interview yesterday for Black Friday. and she was talking about how at TKO last year, she ended up getting down to her very, like, there was a kid who really wanted a balloon and she had one more balloon that she was able to make for that kid at the very end. But yeah, I'm super happy that Nikki is going to be joining us again. I hope that Nikki can just be a part of the kids outside every time because she brings an element that nobody else can bring. And, you know, Nikki Sandoval, not Nikki Brown Cloud, but Nikki actually, she grew up in that neighborhood too. So it makes a lot of sense for her to be a part of what we're doing.
Yeah, that's kind of awesome. You talk about that. Going down literally to the last balloon. And, you know, hopefully that kid remembers that.
Right.
But to that point, do you have like memories of events kind of like this, whether it be in your community or just that kind of like stuck out to you?
As far as like in my childhood?
Yeah. Like, I guess.
I mean, I don't think any come to mind right off the bat. Not for me, at least. Do you?
Yeah, nothing comes to mind like off rip in terms of like a kids event quite like this, but you know, and doing that first one, I think that was the thing that made me feel really good is, you know, we're putting on this concert. It's, you know, we're billing as family friendly hip hop and everything. And it's the first, it was shortly after COVID. And even some people were still kind of touchy about like if COVID is, you know, fully passed and everything. So, you know, you do your legwork. And at that time, you know, we had just like Zoe and I just had our kid. So it was like the amount of promo that we were able to do or I was able to support was limited. But like LaQuisha and Matt were hitting the ground trying to get the word out. But, you know, it's just like once you show up, you get there a little bit early. Like, are people going to show up?
Yeah.
And then to see that park get filled out with hundreds of people, literally, and see that so many of them were kids and families and people who were from there, that was like, oh, we did it right. Mm-hmm. We did this thing right. And it was just like a showing point that like, yeah, if we, the thing that we've put out that the community wants something here is true. Like, mm-hmm. It was like a proven point that people will come to this park because you know, Matt's talked about it a lot that not much has really happened at George. It's not an event space. It's not a place where people are doing things in terms of St. John's. You might go to Cathedral Park or something to do something. But like as somebody who threw an event at Cathedral Park outside of this, like it's expensive and mm-hmm. It's not in the middle of the neighborhood. It's not like it's a beautiful space, but ultimately, you know, this is not the neighborhood park that you just go down to. You got a lot of people. We were talking about the survey earlier. So many people who took the survey said this is like the Passover park. You know, like people say, I live in the neighborhood, but I'm never going to George or I never go there. I have to go to a park down the way. So I think in terms of what we were able to put out there, it really was special to see that people said, yeah, this is the family event that we've been waiting for. And this is the vision that we're hoping to be a part of. So I'm excited to do it again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You kind of touched on that. You're both also not just speaking as event organizers, but as parents with mm-hmm. this. And yeah, I mean, is there a lot of offerings? Even you said like, you don't have any experience with something like this growing up, but Like when you're just like looking for things to do, like, is there a lot going on out there? Or is this kind of like really like filling that gap?
Mm-hmm. I do think that there are, I mean, I am a community organizer and I do host a lot of other events mm-hmm. that aren't related to, TKO. And I do, me and the other people that I organize with try to make sure that every event that we throw is for families and that it's not like if it's a backpack giveaway or something, that we're making sure that families are feeling welcomed and they're feeling like they can hang out and play. It's not like a long line of just, this is what I'm doing and I'm going home type. I do think that, you know, we try to make sure that things are, you know, comfortable for families.
Yeah.
But as far as it being like TKO, no.
Yeah. And I think also just thinking about last year, like so many people ended up hanging out. Like you were just talking about, people were hanging out, mm-hmm. you know, the event, the summer free for all model, you only can have a couple hours, you know, of actual event time, but once the lights were off and everything, people were kicking it, mm-hmm. you know, and it was last year was later, you know, it was 6 to 8. So it was more of a stretch for parents to be there, you know, because bedtime, whew, mm-hmm. and definitely know as a parent, like bedtime is a real crucial time. You got to hit it on the hour. So people were stretching themselves to be out there, but they wanted to be. This time we're doing it 2 to 4 o'clock. You know, on a Saturday, same date though, August 26th, just by chance. But I think that was the energy that was around last year's event, is I think it was a chance for people to connect and reconnect. And I think in terms of like, if we're filling a void, I think we're filling a void for St. John's,
yeah.
like in terms of that neighborhood and the ethos of what this work is about. Because yeah, you can go to things like PDX Parent and there's no shortage of like things that are happening for kids and for families, right. but in the way that we're doing it from the ground up with the community and, you know, pushing for something larger in the way that we are, because again, it's not just an event, you know, this is a part of a larger thing. I think, yeah, there is nothing like this right now.
Right. And it's specifically for a certain neighborhood. Right. There's not a lot like that.
Yeah. So this is lastly, is there any other messages you would have for families who might be interested or anyone who might be interested in TKO2?
Yeah, I think one of the things we haven't mentioned, we're going to have caricature artists there.
Yuri Frazier, yeah.
Yeah.
A friend of mine is going to come in.
Yeah, we're going to have that.
So like the caricature artist, I feel like I'm just going to pretend I don't understand the word caricature. Can you tell me more?
Yeah, so he does portraits of people, like, you know, drawings of people.
Yeah, like the big head on the
yeah.
So I think that's gonna be real fun mm-hmm. part of this. And actually just this week came up with something that's gonna be super fun, I think, for everybody that's in the park. Not saying what it is, but you'll definitely want to stay till mm-hmm. the end for that. And you know, this year we made some invites to some electeds from the area who represent North Portland. So Commissioner Jayapal from Multnomah County Commissioners is going to be there and say some words. But I think that's less the event side, and just like the hope is that we can, like I said, continue to see recognition from these people in the seats to see that there's a vision here and that we're not trying to wait till TKO 10 to like see something happen. We want to see something. We are already sitting on fertile ground. We don't want to wait until the city of Portland comes up with the master plan and goes through their engagement processes. The engagement process is happening right now, and recognizing that the person I just named is on the county side, but the more that you can bring people together in any of these seats to realize vision, I think the better. So we're excited about, you know, that. And I think this year, even more so than last year, we're seeing more community support for this vision. We are seeing more organizations coalesce around TKO and trying to see how they can get involved. So I think, like I said, we had nearly 300 people come out for that first one. I have a feeling that we can go bigger this year. So it's going to be fun. There's going to be plenty to do. There's going to be a lot of organizations out there that you can get tapped in with. And ultimately, just come and be a part of something special.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's important you talk about getting city and county leadership to come in some ways be involved, or at least just see that community effort. Because like when you were just mentioning light poles earlier, as I was thinking like, oh yeah, that's right, we talked about this in studio like earlier this year, because there's a story about the city pulling 243 light poles across 12 city parks and that it would take something, I want to say like 18 months or something to replace. I'm just like,
that's crazy.
Yeah. Well, everyone's, you know, hand-wringing about safety. I wonder what that will do. Like,
it's crazy, especially because it was, at least my understanding is that it was predicated by one person deciding to set up a hammock between some light poles and the light pole falling. And they're like, the infrastructure is terrible here. Well, maybe that's not what the light pole is built for. Like, that's not what light poles are supposed to have happen. So everybody's saying, yeah, let's pull all the light poles. Let's pull them all up. Because people are just putting hammocks on them left and right. and man, that was crazy. That was crazy to witness. And then they paused it. Mm. You know, they paused it because I think there was a realization that, like, yeah, I don't know why that happened, how it happened. But meanwhile, George Park remains dark. Oh, bars. Did you catch that? George Park remains dark. Oh, bars.
For those watching, Dava, you had the short-lived radio show where things like this happen. So I'm not just rolling my eyes as like a rude host. This is historical. Oh, man. Before I let you go, also the art on this, art on the poster by Alex Wright. So mm-hmm. Numbers Family, shout that out. But yeah, Kids Outside Festival 2, Saturday, August 26th, 2 to 4 p.m. at George Park. Thank you all for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Hope to see you all there.
All right.
The Bruce Poinsett Show will be back right after these messages.
The Bruce Poinsett Show is made possible by the support of members at patreon.com/BrucePoinsett. Patreon is a service that allows you to directly support creators like myself through monthly or annual memberships. Become a member for as little as $3 a month and get access to exclusive bonus clips and live discussions. Check out this clip from the page.
Are you defending the prequels? Where does your defense end, Bruce?
So, you know what? Maybe this might surprise you, but yeah, the whole meal deal. I will defend the prequels, kind of. Again, I also had a disclaimer at the beginning that I would not put money on me if I were betting on this as a viewer, but will I defend the prequels? Yes. If you enjoy this content and believe in the community I'm trying to build, please support by becoming a member at patreon.com/BrucePoinsett.
Welcome back to the Bruce Poinsett Show.
What's up, everyone? It's Bruce. And today we need to talk about media literacy because Willamette Week has had a couple of truly, truly unfortunate headlines and that have caused unfortunate reactions in the city in the past couple of weeks. And, you know, it's easy to talk about please read the full story. But obviously, we know people don't. We know people react. So we got to talk about how this works. Let's start
start with the most recent story, which was law enforcement officials suspect Multnomah County man released early from prison is a serial killer. So this went around, and should note, by Nigel Jaquise and Lucas Manfield. Fun fact, Lucas Manfield and I actually were in English class throughout high school. So it was interesting connections. But yeah, this headline went around, scared a lot of people because, you know, they're posting about not just the idea that, you know, a serial killer is on the loose, but also the article and, you know, subsequent social media posts, especially on Instagram and Twitter, were linking the release of this man, because I guess it was part of Kate Brown trying to, you know, or Kate Brown. the governor, releasing people from prison to, you know, stop jail overcrowding, stop, just the excesses of the prison industrial complex. And basically, what does that do? That makes people say, oh my goodness, these policies are, they're endangering the people. You're letting dangerous criminals run the streets. And a serial killer? Are you kidding? What are we doing? So, fun fact of this article. And you can see it, actually, let's bring it back. Because maybe you missed it on the first share screen. So if you look, and even the subhead, which you don't see, especially in the social media post, although they will note this in the caption, Jesse Lee Calhoun is in custody. In custody. He's not been charged yet. He's in custody. He's clearly a suspect in this case. So actually, there is not a serial killer on the loose. They're actually investigating him for this, and he is in custody. But you've already done the damage by noting the program to release people from prison and suggesting that it has, one of the results has been letting a serial killer on the loose. And, you know, again, just sparking the idea of, like, Oregon has these crazy, you know, radical liberal policies that are actually endangering people. And a lot of people, again, they only see the headline. I think the Instagram post was the one that got me the most, just because you see the headline, but then in the caption, as opposed to the subhead in the story, they note, and it's at the end of the caption too, that he is in custody. And it's just like, you're misleading people. You're absolutely misleading people. But that was this week, I believe. A week and a half for that, we got a real doozy. Now, let me share this one with you. Multnomah County will distribute tinfoil and straws to fentanyl smokers. It's similar to other, in air quotes, harm reduction efforts nationwide. Again, by my old classmate, Lucas Manfield. So, if you're not in Portland, you can probably guess how this was received. We're in the middle of a fentanyl epidemic. You know, homelessness is increasing every day. And a lot of people took this like, wait, we're in crisis, and you're going to help drug addicts do more drugs? What are you doing? This is crazy. This is not... Again, the idea, the perception of Portland as this place of, you know, these crazy liberal policies that are out of control and the city is burning down because of them. But again, if you, one, read the story, they do quote actual, you know, people who do work with people with addiction, You know, this is not, people actually do harm reduction methods in other cities. This is just as a way to distribute. Yes, it is paraphernalia, but also to, so people can at least more safely do the drugs they were already going to do, to hopefully reduce, because again, it's harm reduction. It's not the ultimate solution. It's not the ultimate goal. But when you have people dying on the streets, the hope is to have less people dying on the streets. And it's just one measure. Yet, how do people respond? Poorly. You had, again, chaos, Portland. What is this? What are we doing? How, why are we giving tinfoil and straws to fentanyl smokers? How, what kind of crazy plan is this? So, of course, that breaks out, you know, on social media into arguments between people who have some concept of harm reduction and people who really didn't, really don't. And also, you know, I'm me personally, I don't get into a lot of like Twitter stuff. I don't care. I really don't. But, you know, I'll watch the train wreck like a lot of people. So saw a lot, of discussions again, where people are saying, how dare you do this? And like, they're ignoring some of the like facts in the article to continue making their case. They're ignoring any concept of, or studies, other applications of harm reduction in other cities that this is based on. And when pressed about, okay, so what should we do instead of this? Guess what the solution is? We need to better enforce the laws. We need more police to arrest these people on the streets. And like, that's not just, you know, the people who, you know, like Mingus Maps and Renee Gonzalez supporters. It's not just, you know, people for Portland. It's not just conservatives. It's a lot of people you would not otherwise think of who, when pressed, are like, no, no, bring in more police for this. Arrest these people. Get there. I'm tired of seeing this on the streets. It's the very, it's a destructive way of thinking about it. Because even if your goal is saying, I don't like seeing this on the streets, we need to do something, having, if the place you arrive at is we need more police to brutalize the people, that's actually not going to solve the problem. Even if you actually believe that, would that does not, we've proven it. We've seen it. It doesn't solve the problem. People complain about downtown Portland, and it's exaggerated, but you know, there's a real homelessness issue. And yet, guess what hasn't made that better? Giving more money to the police. Diverting, because in order to give money to the police, or give more money to the police budget, you got to divert money from other things. And it's usually stuff like the community services, is the other things that, you know, actually prevent poverty and suffering. But you're taking money from that, so that, one, you're causing more harm and suffering. You're causing more, putting more people in a desperate position. And then just giving more money to the police to then deal with that. Again, it's very counterproductive. But after a weekend, at least with this story, you know, it was saying, well, Noah County will distribute, meaning the policy had gone through. But guess what? After a weekend of internet arguing, where do you think we landed? Well, Noah County reverses plan to distribute foil to fentanyl smokers. Yep. And notice in the subhead, Willamette Week first reported the new harm reduction strategy last week. Notice how harm reduction is no longer in air quotes. Again, Lucas. But, you know, the job was done by then. And it's unfortunate, because actually more people are now going to die. more people are going to suffer. More people, like, even if you're like, hey, no, we need to put more resources into addiction support services, you know, people to work with people, things to get help for people. We didn't do that either. All we did was just like slash one harm reduction measure and, you know, raise the volume on people who would like to use this as an opportunity to funnel more money to the police to, again, not solve the problem. And this is a, you know, we use these two examples from Willamette Week, but this has kind of been a consistent part of the infrastructure for just depowering progressive policy and policymakers in Portland. I think it really echoes of when Joanne Hardesty, former city councilor who was defeated by Rene Gonzalez, was falsely charged with a hit and run, and Portland police officer Brian Hunziker was kind of like led that effort. Let's pull that one up in case you didn't hear about that, in case you forgot. So back when she was on the city council, yeah, Commissioner Joanne Hardesty was falsely accused of hit and run that the Portland Police Union then blasted out. And of course, once you put the headline out there, you can't take it back, and the smear is done. Now, again, it was found to be false. She sued. But guess what? PPB reinstates officer who leaked report that falsely accused Hardesty of hit and run. February 2nd, 2023. So, even though someone did a very malicious act of manipulating the media system, it got its job done. It helped depower Joanne Hardesty just a little bit. She ended up losing her election. It's not all on this hit and run charge, but it's part of a larger, bigger effort to just kind of like hit her from all directions and attack the person who was basically the champion of progressive policy on the city council at the time, and get her out of there, which they did, replaced with a conservative. I guess he's a Democrat, but, you know, that only means with so much in Portland. So, and it's all just that's how these the politics, the lobbying organizations, specifically the Portland Business Alliance, I believe they've changed their name to like the Portland Metro Council, you know, lobbying groups like People for Portland, say lobbying, more like propaganda groups, who, you know, put billboards around the city, again, that basically work as anti-tourism ads, you know, basically suggesting, again, that the city is in chaos, is in flames because of these dangerous progressive policies and just going overboard in a way that actually isn't happening. But it all serves the purpose, again, of depowering progressive policy, depowering progressive policy makers. And it, you know, it gets its money's worth as far as this interaction between policymakers, you know, lobbying interests, and media. So as I mentioned before, with some of like the debates that spilled out on social media, it divides a lot of people who would otherwise be comrades, or that might be the generous way of putting it. It exposes the divisions between people who might otherwise be comrades and exploits them. One, in terms of the message it puts out to, you know, people in the suburbs, people outside of Oregon. Again, it makes this perception that it is this like liberal bastion utopia that's gone too far, when in reality, we have a city council right now with four city councilors and the mayor. So it's, you know, five people serving on the city council, four, including the mayor, very decidedly conservative. And are passing a lot of policies to, again, defund community organizations, pump more money into the police, defunds, you know, necessary services and resources for the most vulnerable people in the city. It's not particularly liberal or progressive at all, but you listen to, you know, I listen to influencers, watch influencers from places like Atlanta, and they're talking about Portland, you know, the same way. Like they're basically just repeating the same messages from these anti-tourism ads, these things demonizing progressives in the city, because, you know, what other message? That's the loudest bullhorn. That's the loudest, you know, it's the loudest messaging they're hearing. They're not hearing, you know, people on the ground. They're not hearing the actual progressive people in the city. They're just hearing this perception because they have the money to put it out there. Same way, again, like in the suburbs, I grew up, as I've talked about before, I grew up in Lake Oswego, you know, Lake No Negro, Oregon. And it's funny how a lot of people from LO who participated in those same 2020 protests. And yet when you see these ads during the midterm elections showing, you know, footage of the protests and, you know, with the scary music and talking about how Portland's burning down and how these defund the police radicals are destroying the city. Like the people in LO buy it, you know, hook, line and sinker, even though they know people who went into those protests. Some of them are their kids, but they see that image, they see the music, they want to believe these things. So they do. So it just, it feeds this narrative so that, you know, when someone wants to run, you know, like Mingus Mass running for mayor wants to, you know, say he's going to try and like get the city in order. And, you know, when especially Republicans, but a lot of basically Republican Democrats get out here and say things have gone too far, they use that perception and the weight that perception holds amongst people, especially outside of Portland, as kind of like another tool to legitimize themselves. Because, again, sometimes perception can be stronger than reality, at least as far as the hold it has over people. And, you know, we can only hope with these efforts that, you know, they're not further successful, and not successful in, you know, propelling Mingus Mass to mayor of the city. Another thing they've been talking about is, even though that 60% of the city voted to pass charter reform, which would, you know, would make it a ranked choice voting system, would expand the city council to 12 seats, not including the mayor. And it had people, basically three people from like four different parts of Portland would be able, you know, would be serving on city council. The mayor would not have the vote he has now. But you have efforts again from Rene Gonzalez, another city councilor, Dan Ryan, who want to put in reforms that no one asked for actually to the charter right now. What are those reforms, you ask? One of them is shrinking that number of 12 city councilors back down to 8. And the simplest way to explain that is it's easier to control 8 people than it is 12. They also want to give the mayor veto power, which I'd say runs completely counter to a decision to expand the city council to 12 seats and get the mayor out of that vote entirely. It's literally, it's the opposite. It is literally not what the voters asked for. But the same forces that behind, you know, giving you these headlines, behind these stories, behind kind of like raising that panic, like it also works towards this goal. There's a protest today at city council, you know, in favor of supporting the charter reforms that people voted on. And even then, you know, the reports from that were just like, when one, they weren't even going to let, there's supposed to be a work session on the charter. It was supposed to be a public work session. And then initially they were Shout out to Alex Zelensky on the reporting. But initially, they weren't going to let people in with the protest there into this public work session. They had to reverse that. And then once you had the people, advocates from the city, they did what they do. And just, you know, you had these condescending kind of city council questioning periods, which is kind of just, again, it's become the case when they were trying to defund, again, NEA, Latino Network, Urban League, forgetting one, my apologies. Or when they tried to, you know, when they tried to take the money from an organization specifically around alternatives to policing, it's always been the same thing where they bring the people in a very public platform and just, you know, they just demean you and gaslight you in front of everybody. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how obvious it is, because it's not for the people, it's for these interests. It's just to keep advancing these policies that the Portland Business Alliance, or excuse me, Portland Metro Council is trying to advance. So what can we do about this? Because again, misleading headlines, how they, you know, help certain political causes, specifically the powerful, that's not new. But we can't just, we're in a situation where media itself is like losing its infrastructure, it's losing its funding, its ability to be agile, to serve people increasingly every day. So how do we fight against these misinformation, disinformation campaigns, these frankly just bad faith headlines about, especially about progressive policy? One, I think we got to name the need over and over for media literacy. Like, it should not just be, these things affect policy. A weekend of effectively like Twitter debates ended a harm reduction policy that will very well result in more lives lost on the streets of Portland. So media literacy just cannot be something that you just get in, you know, if you happen to have the privilege, the money to go to journalism school. So yes, I can tell, don't get me wrong, I'm going to beat that drum of read the actual story. Don't just read the headline, read the story. But we need more. When we understand that, guess what? People are pressed for time. People are just scrolling. They're getting a lot of their access to news from the social media accounts, and they're engaging with it that way. You can't just pretend that doesn't exist, or can't just tell people, well, read the actual story, do what I did in journalism school, without anything else. It's proven that people don't care. So how do we respond? We need to, those of us who do have the information, those of us who do have some of this background, you know, on an individual level, we can give advice. Again, number one, read the actual story. Also, very much encourage people, research things you're unfamiliar with. In this case, harm reduction. It could have been such a more productive discourse if people actually like kind of like understood anything about harm reduction, what it means, what are the implications, you know, where it's been applied before. Or you could just, you know, jump on your assumptions and say, given we're helping drug addicts do more drugs, what's going on? Like, I don't know about you, but when something seems kind of a little bit off, ask some questions, do some research. You know, if it feels like it's meant to like incite you, you should be cautious of being incited. But those are more individual suggestions that people with platforms can make to those who are listening? That said, most of us, again, we're getting this news, we're scrolling through our timelines, we're engaging it in that little, you know, what, 5-10 seconds, and then going about our day. So how do we combat that? Support local journalism infrastructure. We recently had an interview on this channel for the HB 2605, the Support Local Journalism Act. And just to remind you, I had Andrew Devigall and Jody Lawrence Turner to talk about that, and watch that on the channel. Subscribe, please. You know, again, support local journalism. But the funding, again, a lot of this comes to funding and like who's actually in these newsrooms, who's on staff versus, you know, who's a maybe sometimes contributor, who's a guest contributor, who's a regular, but only a regular for 2 years, which may seem like a lot, but it's a lot different from 10. It's a lot different from being a staple, an institution, you know, as a personality or as a source of news. So actually, like, these measures that support the funding so we can have more journalists in general, more perspectives in these newsrooms is important. Because when you don't, you have a few people who are kind of like dominating the shaping of the narrative. And you also have sources. So, you know, Willamette Week, Oregonian, despite ever increasing, and they're certainly not, you know, they're not like, the word I'm looking for. You know, they are also subject to this. They're also dealing with, you know, newsroom cuts, struggles with funding, and like the transition to, you know, how we consume media in 2023 versus the past. Like, you know, Oregonian is dealing with that. Willamette Week is dealing with that. Because they are bigger, more established local outlets, they're able to weather that storm a lot differently than, you know, smaller community papers, smaller independent outlets who, as opposed to weathering the storm, are just shutting down, or, you know, they're shutting down their newsrooms so that all they get wire news, or basically like national news they pull from other sources, but they aren't able to do any actual reporting. So in the midst, in that vacuum, what you get is the voices of a few reporters at the major outlets who have their own, you know, conflicts of interest in terms of, and also just traditions and how they've always operated. And that kind of shapes the discussion even more so than it already would in a more robust media landscape. So supporting these efforts to, again, provide more funding, bring more journalists into the room, train more people, you know, also to that effort, in addition to supporting the newsroom, it's also important, again, support journalism education, especially, I think, in schools and at a community level. Like, kids, you know, I teach in schools, middle schools, high school, or I teach middle schoolers, high schoolers, and I'm always, you know, always surprised, sometimes scared about how much info on fact checking they've never received. They've never been taught like how to research things. It's like, it's only, I shouldn't say only, but it's, you know, these journalism classes, these courses where I'm, you know, a guest teacher for like 10 sessions out of a school year. Like, this is where they're getting the most focused attention on this. And it just happens to be, if I happen to be working with the right group, or in, you know, other programs I work with, if I'm selected by the right teacher looking through a catalog of potential guest writers to come in, like if those circumstances align and the timing works out, then some of these kids might get just a little piece of this information that they need. But again, media literacy or lack thereof affects us all. It affects how we consume the media. It affects how we then make decisions based off our access to that information and how we consume it. So when we invest in the funding of journalism programs, journalism courses, journalism teaching, whether it's at the schools, but also community groups provide this as well. And it's an opportunity because, again, media literacy is not, it's not exactly there for adults either, but it's necessary and it's worth, you know, I know there's so many crises we're dealing with. And when people already don't really understand media, it's hard to understand why you should put more funding into media, but it is clearly affecting us all. And we need to support it. We need to build it, build that understanding, build that literacy, support, also support a lot of jobs that people get, like teaching this is a job. A reporter is a job. You know, people are able to feed their families, pay their bills, support the economy through these jobs. Like there's a lot of clear reasons, obvious reasons, why we should be supporting more media literacy in general and just a more robust, diverse, and agile media environment in general. And it all comes down to money. Are we willing to put our money into it? You know, I can be on here and tell you again, support the Patreon. I am an independent media creator. And, you know, that's one thing. But whether you support me, whether you support someone else, support. Whether, and not just, again, there's the individual level, but on a larger systemic, on a policy level, we need to be putting real funding towards our, as people at UOPDX like to say, our info health, our build, you know, the way we engage, not just with the information and what's happening around us, but how we do it effectively, how we do it more effectively, how we do it in a way that supports the betterment of our communities and the people around us. Because right now, clearly, it's being used in a way, you know, the media, as it's always been, to be fair, but it's being used in a way that's, it's kind of in bad faith. It's, I want to say malicious all the time. A lot of the time it's malicious, but it's definitely harmful. And, you know, the, at least from, especially from a progressive policy standpoint, like it is doing major damage all across the board. So we gotta do something better. We gotta, again, invest in our information health because lives are literally at stake.
Twitch.tv/TheNumbersFM, that's numbers with a Z, or on the Numbers Podcast Network on all podcasting platforms, or thenumberspodcast.com. Again, that's numbers with a Z.